Okay, welcome back to this session, the second session. Okay, we are doing the same thing, the recitation of Heart Sutra and the mandala after that, okay? So, are you ready with the Heart Sutra? Okay. I prostrate to the Arya Triple Gem. Thus did I hear at one time the Bhagavan was dwelling on mass of Vulture Mountain in Rajagriha, together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. At that time, the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. Also at the time, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara looked upon the various practice of profound perfection of wisdom and beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Then through the power of Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said this to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara: how should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom? He said that, and the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said this to the Venerable Shariputra: Shariputra, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom should look upon this like this, correctly and repeatedly beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Form is empty, emptiness is form, emptiness is not other than form, form is also not other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness are empty. Shariputra, likewise, all phenomena are emptiness, without characteristic, unproduced, unceased, stainless, not without stain, not deficient, nor fulfilled. Shariputra, therefore, in emptiness, there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body. No mind, no visual form, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, and no phenomenon. There is no eye element and so on up to and including no mind element, no mental consciousness element. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance and so on up to and including no aging and death and no extinction of aging and death. Similarly, there is no suffering, origination, cessation and path. There is no exalted wisdom, no attainment and also no non-attainment. Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, bodhisattva rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom. The mind without obscuration and without fear, having completely passed beyond error, they reach the end point of nirvana. All the Buddhas who dwell in the three times also manifestly completely awaken to unsurpassable, perfect, complete enlightenment in reliance on the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of the great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequal, the mantra that thoroughly satisfies all, to know the truth. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is declared. Te yatha om gate gate para gate para sangate bodhi so. Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like that. Then the Bhagavan arose from that concentration and commended the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, saying, well said, son of the lineage, it is like that, it is like that. One should practice the profound perfection of wisdom just as you have indicated. Even the Tathagatas rejoice. The Bhagavan, having thus spoken, the Venerable Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, those surrounding in their entirety, along with the worlds of God, humans, asuras, gandharvas, were in highly praised, spoken by the Bhagavan. Kala jeben ejo tamba ne ngoshe dhudru ngave rupa bola maye ne zongandru zola cha ze aga samara dashetra. Ah. Aga samara da jadara samara ya pe gere donda gyaju jiva da midune be kenda tumba gyujin buzun so gyube da jide yang tindir dele jo cho jin edo dhamma Listen to the discourse with the proper motive or proper intention. At least at the minimum level, a fabricated level of bodhicitta within your mind, an intention to achieve the Buddhahood in order to benefit all the sentient beings, that kind of mentality, as it is explained repeatedly in the teachings of the great masters of the past. So yesterday I explained two lines from the relative bodhicitta slogans, or we can say the lines on the practice of how to cultivate the conventional bodhicitta. So those were the very important lines. And then after that, now we are looking forward to move further. And those two lines actually contains the essential message of mind training. The essence of the mind training is to cherish others, and if possible, while we cherish others, ignore oneself and give up one's own benefits and one's own well-being. So that was something that we have discussed yesterday. And now the third line here, it is the third line in this section, but in overall lines of this root text, we are at the line number 10. Okay, let me first explain you those things. Yesterday I didn't remember those five filths or the five degenerations. In one version of text, it says that when the five degenerations are flourishing, transform them into the path to enlightenment. And in the other one, this says that transform into the path to enlightenment this time when the five deteriorations are rampant. So anyway, in this text that I'm using, goes like the present when five filths are extremely strong, it will transform them into the path of enlightenment. So these are five degenerations or five deteriorations, whatever we say, or five filths are those deteriorated level of life. That means lifespan. And the two time, as I explained yesterday, and the views or the philosophical standing or standpoint, and then the beings, and then the deteriorated or degenerated or filth of delusion. So those are like at the present time, human beings live extremely short life compared to those that in past used to live thousands of years according to the Buddhist cosmological studies. There were time, there were period when human beings used to live for eons, for hundreds of thousands of years. Now, in the course of time, that lifespan of human being became reduced, and this reduction kept continuing for an extremely long period, and the present time is known as the human beings live all around 100 years. So this is the present time. Now, compared to those past times, those previous eras, it is an extremely degenerated and extremely short lifespan that we live. So it's a deterioration and degeneration in that point. And then time, I explained yesterday how the time is changing and so on. And then the views, philosophical or any kind of views, the more and more we live in a modern era, people tend to have more and more harmful views and harmful philosophical inclinations. Like we can see very clearly that in the degenerated present era, the people with the sense of philosophical inclination to harm other is growing. As a result of that, sense of the activities of terrorism and all those things are growing. So this is a one of the major concerns that is tried to kind of express or try to explain through this degenerated viewpoints or deteriorated or filth of the viewpoint, then the sentient beings, yeah, in the modern, more and more modern era, the sentient beings, the physical strength and the mental capability of the sentient beings also kind of drop down compared to those people, those beings that lived many, many eons ago. So in that sense, it is a deteriorated state and degenerated state in the kind of a filth of sentient beings. And the delusions, the negative and the harmful emotion or the harmful thoughts, those get stronger and stronger as we keep continuing or we can enter into more and more modern era. People start becoming more greedy, people start becoming more self-conscious and kind of self-centered and kind of angry, anger-driven and hatred-driven and those kind of things. So these are the main kind of five factors that kind of entangles the life of a modern human being. So while we are living in a life entangled in such a disturbing factors in a modern era, it is very important to have these instructions of mind training. The mind training, yesterday I told you, sometimes they use the thought transformation as an alternative to this word mind training, and in other ways it can be also used, the kind of training of attitudes or changing of attitudes or transformation of attitudes. Mind is a very specific term that the Tibetans use very often in various different contexts. With the mind, Tibetans can also kind of mean the consciousness. And with the similar word mind, sometimes in certain kind of circumstances, it can only refer to the primary mind. And in certain circumstances, it can refer to kind of inner kind of phenomena. So mind, this word can be used in different ways and for the different meanings with depending on the kind of supporting word that follows. So in this sense, it can be used for the thought, as certain authors or certain translators put forward, or in certain extent it can be used for the attitude. And thought is kind of exceptionally kind of inner and matter of consciousness. But then when we talk about the attitude, there could be physical, vocal and mental attitudes, which is much wider kind of in terms of meaning. But the Tibetan approach is, when we use this word in terms of attitude, everything, the vocal and physical attitudes, always kind of relate back to the mental attitude. So everything is related to the mental kind of thinking and the characteristics and so on. So from that point of view, we can also use that concept. In many occasions, we also use the word meditate. But a Tibetan version of meditate, Tibetan meaning of the Tibetan word meditate, is not necessarily to sit down somewhere kind of upright in a kind of cross-legged position and do some kind of serious mental exercise. Tibetan version of the Tibetan meaning of the word of meditate, gom, is applicable in many in various ways and in many manners. It can be applicable in certain ways to transform the attitude, like the physical way of relating to others and how to react to others, and vocal ways of connecting with others and communicating with others. So all those could be also a part of the meditation, or this word of meditate. So from that angle, while we use this word meditate in terms of mind training, not necessarily means that someone have to sit in certain corner and do mental exercise like that. It may mean to change the attitude and transform the lifestyle and transform one's how we relate to other people, that kind of things, you know. So these are important things to understand. Unless with usage of the word, it may appear like we are entering into a kind of puzzle. They have this puzzle with where a lot of roots and you cannot get the end, you know, mazes. So it's like that. It maybe sometimes it may appear like that, but in reality, it's very important to understand the background meaning of every word. So it's like that. So now let's go to the next word, the 10th one. Giving and taking should be practiced alternately. And in the other version, we have here is train alternately in the two, taking and giving. And then this one, then train in both giving and taking in alternation. So these are little differences of the wordings, but the meaning is all same. What does it mean? Once we have established very strongly that it is very important to cherish others, it is very important to give up the self-cherishing thought, and be grateful to others. If these two values are well established through reasoning and through contemplation and so on, and then someone have inner feeling to do something in that direction, then the next steps comes in, the next line. What does it mean when we get serious about cherishing others and giving up a self-cherishing? Then, in general, we are separated by physical boundaries. Whatever I feel, you cannot feel it physically and mentally. Whatever you feel, I cannot feel it. Or whatever pain I go through, you don't go through that same thing. So the thing is, when we exchange self and others, we need to carry on the practice through the practice of the giving and taking. Giving is tong and taking is len. So this practice of tong len begins here. So how to do that? To take all those discomfort, harm, pain, and suffering, and various types of problems of others from them to oneself, and then give away one's own good deeds, the virtuous deeds, the merits, and wealth, position, fame, prosperity, everything to them. And here, it is initially we need to do it by kind of mentally and to visualize taking those things from them and giving one's own those good things to others. Just imagine in our life, I think bravery awards awarded by the US government to the citizens. Do they have such things? From time to time, I do believe that they do have. Many countries run those kind of programs. So what is the criteria of, general criteria of giving those bravery awards is, but there could be some corruption from time to time, but the general criteria is, if someone does some kind of, amazing act of bravery where they kind of put their own life on risk to save others, those kind of acts are addressed and respected, and in order to recognize those acts, the kind of award of braveries are distributed and provided. So we have to be grateful that such human values such as still exist in this world, that those kind of inner kind of feelings and inner attitudes are respected and kind of appreciated. Now just imagine a bodhisattva willing to put themselves into extreme risk, not just to save one being, not just to save 200 and 200 and 1,000, 10,000, all the living beings, which makes the bodhisattvas extremely outstanding of any kind of spiritual practitioners. So we need to understand that, and try with understanding that, we need to try to train ourselves in these trainings, in these values, which produces the bodhisattva, which are the instructions to produce those kind of persons. So normally what we feel, if we find someone out there suffering, we don't feel to do something to eradicate their suffering, because as a result of that, we don't suffer directly. There is no direct connection to our own pain and suffering and discomfort from that person or from that being out there. So most of the time, as a common human being, we always ignore those things. So this is the main reason. Most of the time we do it in that way. But when the kind of bodhisattvas try to push themselves forward to go against that kind of attitude and transform it and be caring and supportive to those people in order to solve their problem, in order to eradicate their sufferings, they use this kind of logic. It is not a really good and strong logic and reason, because it can't stand in that way. Because if it is like that, if it is the only reason that we can ignore the other people because it is not related to us, their kind of suffering won't bring us any kind of harm and discomfort, then why should we kind of save money while we are young to make sure that when we are old, that we are well cared, or we have something to use for, or we have enough to survive for. Because when we are young, when we are old, we are not anymore young. So being sick at the old time will never bring that feeling to that young person who's already passed away many, many years ago. So this is one very strong reason. If just that kind of reason, saying that it doesn't matter to me, it doesn't bother me, why should I do that? So of course, old person problem will never bother the young man 20 years ago or 30 years ago. So why should that young man work hard to make sure that that old man lives a very good life? Now it could be possible that the person may come up with an answer, say that, oh, it's not same, because other and myself, we are separate entities. We are separate, and the old myself and the young myself is not separate. We are continuity of same human being. So it's not equal, it is different. Then the question, the argument against that the bodhisattvas do is, okay, if it is like that, then why should a kid and the son or the daughter work hard to solve the problems and the pains and the hardship and the harm of their parents? Why should they do that? Normally, as a human being, we do it. Why should we do it? We are separate equally as the other people who we ignore, who are suffering down in the side of the road. So why shouldn't we give up the same thing? Why shouldn't we give up the have the same attitude towards our parents? If the reason is like that, then the probable answer could be, oh, it is different. It's my parents have been very kind and very caring to me, and those people had never been like that. Or it is not comparable in that way. Since my parent has cared for me, I should work to solve their problems. I should work to eradicate their pain and discomforts and harm and all those things. Then the argument of bodhisattvas is, oh, if it is like that, then it will never stand. Your reason will never stand. Because all the sentient beings are equally kind and caring and to us, because they have been caring to us, extremely caring and supportive and helpful to us throughout our lifetimes. Because our life is a continuity of a life from past, and it goes in that way and continues like that. So if we have been living like that, it's very sure that every lifetime, almost every lifetime, we are born from someone or something else. And those someone definitely have cared for us. So what is the big deal about, how can we differentiate? Someone who have cared for us in past, we don't care for them. Someone who has cared for us in just recent past, we will care for them. How can we differentiate that? Does it make really sense? Is there a kind of a strong and good argument against that? So this is the way that bodhisattvas try to establish that one should always care for those sentient beings. Then another argument is, if we are just a separate And because of being separate, we don't need to care for others. If it is like that, then why should our hand kind of move to kind of remove the pains of our leg, remove the pains of our head? If any part of our body kind of end up in having a pain, definitely our hands will be the first kind of tool that will do something to kind of wipe that. So why should we do that? Because hands and those other organs are different, are separate. If the argument is, because these things are connected to one whole kind of thing, these things are part of one whole thing, so there is, it is okay and it is logical to kind of work to kind of wipe and eradicate the pain and disturbance of those different organs by usage of different portions of the body. Then the argument is, if it is like that, so what does, how does the kind of the whole exist? Does it exist by independently, or does it exist by depending on those kind of portions? And if we check in that way, the whole itself is completely existing through depending on its parts. Without the role of the parts, there won't be the whole itself existing. So, for that reason, the accepting something whole as a different from part doesn't really stand in that way. And then the possible argument could be, oh, I myself is very important, so I have to do everything to solve my problem, eradicate and stop the pain and suffering. But for others, I don't need to do it because those are not important for me. If the argument is like that, then it goes back again like this. Because of that kind of attitude, from the beginning, since the time when we have been kind of existing in the samsara, we are cherishing ourselves. Because of that, we are kind of fallen down into these problems. Endless pain and suffering and discomfort. Now, if today we don't give up that kind of attitude and we keep continuing that, then in future we will definitely keep kind of falling into a deep ocean of pain, distress and agony and the sufferings. So here the great Shantideva says in his text, my own happiness and others' unhappiness, if I don't exchange these two, then I will never achieve the Buddhahood. And even while I exist in the samsara, I will never be happy. So it is very important by contemplating in this way to establish that. By reasoning to oneself in this way, to establish that it's very important to cherish others. And by cherishing others, take all those negative things, all those pain and unhappiness and suffering from others to oneself, and visualize those things came in and enter into one's own system, and then as a result of that, oneself experience suffering and pain and discomfort and unhappiness. So this is very important to know. And then the order of this practice is explained in the next line, which says, begin the sequence of taking from the self. Now, it is established that we should or we must cherish others, and by cherishing others more than oneself, we must do the practice of taking and giving. Now, what is the sequence? What is the order of doing the practice of taking and giving is, first we should start taking the pain, discomfort, unhappiness and problems and sufferings of others. Now, for a common practitioner, it could be quite challenging to visualizing that. When oneself is deeply kind of influenced and deeply under the control of self-cherishing thought, it could be very difficult to do that. So in order to train oneself into that, in a very kind of orderly manner, one should begin from one's own self. Try to visualize one's own self. If the practitioner is doing the meditation in the morning, try to visualize the time of that evening that oneself getting into some kind of problem, and at that moment in that morning, that problem that which is supposed to come up in the evening, take it out from that being that will be there in the evening, to take it out and take to oneself at that morning. So if oneself try to take one's own problems, advance those problems from that moment to previous or earlier moment, and train from that kind of methodology, that could be very helpful for the beginners. And then when one gets trained in that way, they can extend it further. Maybe visualize tomorrow's problem is taken in advance today, and next week's problems and the sufferings and the pains, or possible pains, possible sufferings is taken in advance at this moment. And that way, problem that is supposed to arise 10 years later, or that may arise 10 years later, is taken in advance at this moment. In that way, if the practitioner keep practicing, then when those things, circumstances arises, the practitioner may not feel any kind of agony and distress. So then, once the practitioner is well trained in that manner, then they can extend it to the other beings. So, this is very important to understand in this way. And it can be extended to the, initially, it can be extended to the relatives, those close friends. From first oneself, then it goes to the close friends and the close relatives, and then it can move further to the neutral persons. Those are not our friends, not our enemies. And then it can be extended further to the our enemies, small-time enemy. And then it can be further extended to the worst enemy of our life, or ours, of our own self. If it is done in that way, then that could be very helpful to train oneself and especially and cherish others and care for others in that way. And then, from that manner, it can be extended further and further to all the living beings, all the sentient beings. So this is a very, very kind of a practical, sequenced order. Unless, if we don't do it in that way, then we just try to be a kind of imaginative kind, imaginatively kind to other people. Like, as long as people don't bother us, like those people, all the way down in the Africa, South Africa, I'm very kind to them. I'm very caring and kind to them. But when it comes to our own people surrounding us, fight them and then do all the things to harm them and then damage their property and damage their fame and all those things, that doesn't make sense. That is a kind of a improper way of applying these instructions in the life. So it's very important to apply these instructions initially to oneself, and then the people surrounding us, and then from that in that manner have it expanded little by little, further and further. If it isn't done in that way, that more practical, down-to-earth, kind of realistic manner, then that will help us to achieve or cultivate the bodhicitta. Unless, that kind of imaginative things will never help. Then, the line number 12 is, these two should ride the breed, or these two should mount the breed, and which is in the other version. Okay, the previous line reads in the other version like this: begin taking with yourself, mount the two upon the breed. And in this version, as for the order of taking, start from myself, mounting those two on the breed. These are the different versions of translation. Anyway, the next instruction is, while we do the practice of tonglen, taking and giving, In fact, when we read this word tonglen is giving and taking, but in the actual practice, giving should come second and taking should be first. So the order, the practicing order is like that, but when it is pronounced, or when it is in a grammatical order based on smooth to say the Tonglin comes, Tonglin is more smoother to say. In Tibetan, it doesn't make any sense to say Lentong, you know? So it's like that. So people should not get confused, like it's a giving and taking, so we should do the kind of giving first and taking kind of later. It's not like that. Taking should be done first and giving is later on. Once all those negativities and all those problems have been taken out, so the people and all the sentient beings have become free from the problems, now start giving all those things away, so that now they have achieved, now they have received all the good things, merit, wealth, property and fame and status, power and everything. It makes them complete. So that is the order. And after that, it is important to feel that once the practice of taking is done, after that it is important to feel that, oh, since I have taken all those negative sufferings, pain and disharmony and problems, all those things from their life has been become free from all these things. It is very important to have that kind of feeling generated within oneself. Then once, after that, the things are given away, then to cultivate an understanding that as a result of that, they received all those things. Now they are enjoying great happiness by receiving those things. So this is good to do it in that way. And if it is done in that way, then it really helps us, helps that practice to reduce various types of kind of negative emotions. Hatred, anger, and jealousy, and sense of stinginess, and a lot of those things. So, so this step, this line, these two should mount the breath. That means when we do the practice of taking, we can use, breathing is a natural process to human being. So we can use this natural process to support us, to help us to carry on the practice. So how should we do is, while we visualize that for the initial practitioner, while we breathe in, if we are at the morning, now at this moment, we can breathe in this evening's problems, possible problems, or maybe imagined problems of oneself, that those problems, when we breathe in, has came out of that person at that moment, out of that person's body and system, and it entered into our own body and system. And as a result of that, we felt pain and discomfort. And that person out there at that moment became free from those things. So this is how we mount the practice of taking on the breath. And then, after that, when we breathe out, we can mount the practice of giving on the natural process of breathing. When we mean, when we breathe out, we can visualize all the good things, our wealth, our fame, our property, our kind of prosperity, and our knowledge and wisdom, everything came out from our system in the form of kind of a attractive and good those wealth and precious things, and it goes down to those that person, and that person receives it. After receiving it, that person enjoys a great happiness and great satisfaction. So that kind of thing. Now it applies to all the other beings in the similar way. When we do it to an expanded circle of friends, we can do it in a similar way. Breathing in, while we're breathing in, take in the negativities and sufferings and problems and all those things. While we breathe out, visualize all the good things have gone to them. So those kind of things. So it's a very, very kind of a very, very skillful method to use a natural kind of natural thing that exists in our life and in our own body to kind of help ourselves in our practices. And the next line reads, three objects, three poisons, and three seeds of virtue, which goes in the other version like this. There are three objects, three poisons, and three roots of virtue. Virtue, and then in this one, with regard to the three objects, taking the three poisonous attitudes and giving the three roots of what's constructive. So, quite a bit of distinction between these translations, the usage of words. So these three objects, we need to understand three objects. The three objects are the attractive, inattractive, or maybe the ugly, or kind of then attractive, unattractive, and the neutral. These are the three objects that is referred to, referred in by three objects, and three poisons. Three poisons are the attachment or the desirous attachment, the hatred or the anger, and then the delusion or kind of dullness of the mind. And sometimes some translator, they use naivety, N-A-I-V-E-T-Y. So those kind of things. So these three things are produced by coming into contact with the three objects in our life. And then comes out the three seeds of virtue. The three seeds of virtue are the root of the virtue named detachment, or kind of absence of desirous attachment, and the root of virtue named absence of anger or hatred, or in other words, they use imperturbability. It's a very long word. And then the root of virtue named absence of dullness or delusion, but delusion is very general kind of term. So dullness, it's a kind of dullness of the mind, or kind of absence of a certain degree of intellectual capability, or a kind of a mind with a limited capability to understand, or that kind of thing. And here they use the lack of naivety, you know. So it doesn't matter. So these three things, how does it work? In our life, with related to these three objects, when we see an attractive and kind of a suitable and appealing object, it triggers the desirous attachment. Just take some example from our life. Most of you go to the supermarket, or maybe to the kind of the mall. And if you go to the mall at the end of the kind of walk, you end up in buying something, even though you never have kind of expected, or you never have planned when you went there in the beginning. Why? Because when our kind of senses come in contact with these objects out there, very attractive, very colorful, finely done, and kind of displayed in a very, very kind of attractive manner. And especially in this country and the Western society, where there is a kind of a huge research done in how to attract the consumer. How to attract the consumer. They are very, very skilled in doing that. And they know where to put the things and how to make the things like more attractive and appealing, all those things. And it's really very destructive. You go there, in the beginning, when you step into this kind of a mall, you may never have thought that you are going to buy something. But when you end up in taking a kind of whole circle, probably you end up in having few bags in your hand, you know. Why it is like that? Because this, it stimulates. There are stimulants. It's as soon as we are kind of senses come in contact with, like as soon as I happen to see very kind of, especially for the woman, very colorful and sparkling those tiny bit of ornaments, I feel like, I should have this, I should have that, I should have that. Now for, generally for other, even for men, there could be a lot of things. So it triggers that desire to have it. So generally it is like that. Now, if we happen to go there in a music store, there will be a lot of music playing. So initially you may never have planned to buy something, but at the end you may end up in buy something. So this is how it works. It's a very common, it's a kind of a, you know, realistic approach that happens to every one of us. So in connection to attractive things, the desirous attachment is kind of produced. Now then, when we come in touch with unattractive, ugly things, then anger and hatred and sense of distancing oneself from that appears. A very common concept in the West is monster, you know. From the childhood, you say monster, something like that is ugly and that is kind of not smooth to your eyes. So that's monstrous. And you try to distance yourself from that. And sense of kind of willing to get away from that. So that kind of thing is triggered by coming into contact with that object. Then, if we get neutral objects, then with the neutral object, we even don't feel the desirous attachment and the kind of that sense of willing to distance. We also don't feel that. It's a neutral approach. Almost kind of appeals almost like no activity, no mental functioning. But here, in a kind of in terms of three poisons, we say a mental sense of dullness, a lack of activity, lack of kind of activeness is there. It is also a kind of type of a fault. Of the mind. So that kind of thing is produced in that case. Now to get rid of those things, what we need is We need these three roots of virtue that I've told earlier, which is said, we need a sense of detachment. We need a sense of absence of desire. Unless we have this absence of desire maintained, as soon as we come in contact with those things, the desire will be produced, or a sense of a kind of detachment is maintained, we will happen to have that desirous attachment produced. So it's very important to maintain this. It is almost like an antidote against the desirous attachment. So it's known as the root of the virtue. And in order to avoid hatred and anger, when we come into contact with a kind of uncomfortable and ugly objects out there, then we need to maintain, here it says imperturbability, in the other sense, an absence of the anger and the hatred. An absence of hatred and anger is maintained, then that kind of problem will not arise. And when we come into contact with neutral objects, we need to maintain, and here says lack of naivety, but normal activity of the mind. Normal activeness of the mind. So then we won't, the mind's activeness won't go down and cease or maybe reduced. So for that reason, these are named three roots of virtues, which is very important to maintain. So, for one's own self, it is very important to train in that way, and to other beings, whoever lives, it is very important to pray that may those beings live that kind of life, free from three poisons and with three antidotes and the roots of the virtue maintained or cultivated. And then we have 15. The line number 15 is to remind that, line number 14 and 15 is in a different order here. In the Tibetan, the line number lower one is the line number 14 is the one that is in 15 in English. So the 14 says that use subsequent condensed quintessential instruction to remind that. So what does it mean? We need to use those instructions that comes from the Lojong mind training texts to keep us reminding of these values again and again. For that reason, it is important to memorize these things. Unless we memorize these things, how can we remember those things? So in Tibetan tradition, from the childhood, kids are always encouraged and in fact pushed to memorize a whole lot of texts. Once they have it memorized, and have it recited for a long time, it will be very easy for them to recall it whenever it is necessary. Now in West, it seems like memorizing is not encouraged, or in fact, sometimes they discourage people to do the memorization. Now, if we don't memorize, how can we recall those words? There is no way. Just imagine every time carrying the whole kind of bunch of books with you all over the world. It doesn't really make sense. Probably now with the computer, it may be much, much easier. If it is computerized, you can carry whole kind of a lot of those information in that. But every time when you like to do a meditation, you need to open your computer. It doesn't make any sense again. And if someone tells you, do you want to do a meditation? Oh, wait a minute, I need to open my computer and do the meditation. It doesn't really make sense, you know. So for that reason, it's very important to memorize at least those essential lines, if not whole text, those essential important instructions. Memorize those things. If you memorize those things, you can recall it anywhere, in any part of the world, whenever you are traveling, wherever you are. Will you be on the beach? Will you be on the mountain, top of the mountain? Will you be on a street, maybe in a Wall Street, in a very busy street? You can recall that. So, like that, you know. For that reason, it's very important. At least try to kind of memorize some of those very condensed, very compact, but very important text. That will always give you a lot of advantage and a lot of benefit. So then, this line reads in the other versions like this. These, in brief, are the instructions for the post-meditation period. It's a little different. And here in this one, the guideline instructions for after absorption are in brief to incite saying mindful of this. Now these are very, very different. Very, very distinct translation. And the meaning is like that. And then the next line is, in all activities, train with slogans, which in this version reads, train yourself with the verses during all activities. And this one, by training with words in all paths of behavior. So, what does it mean? Whatever we do in our life, will we be walking, strolling, sleeping, and kind of idling somewhere, or kind of relaxing, or working, or kind of eating, drinking, whatever we do, it is good to have these slogans or these lines of the mind training recalled again and again, not just recalled, and saying it loudly from one's mouth. So there are a lot of such passages which one can use, but then here one famous passage is, may I harvest all the negativities and non-virtuous deeds of others. May others enjoy all the virtuous deeds and the merits of me. That kind of slogan, that kind of verses. If we memorize it and keep repeating throughout our day loudly, that will keep us reminding the values and keep us on track. And then beside that, there are a whole lot of those texts and treaties which comes with a kind of lot of important instructions on mind training, like the Avatamsaka Sutra and the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, the Bodhicharya Avatara, all those things. We can take various praises from that or various verses from that and have it memorized and kind of recited loudly throughout the time, wherever we are, and in that way keep those conduct dictated by those slogans. Now up to this point, these are all the instructions related to how to train in the relative or the conventional bodhicitta, and these are the main instructions of mind training, all the kind of essential instructions of mind training. Now after that, we are getting into the next portion, which is the slogans or the lines to train into the ultimate bodhicitta. Now the first line here goes like this: after gaining stability, teach the secret. And in this one it says, having attained stability, be shown the secret. And this one it says that what is hidden is to be shown after attaining stability. So the thing is, once the practitioner has already trained initially well in the common practices, and after that trained well in the practices of the conventional bodhicitta and the kind of method aspect of the path, the bodhicitta, then after having a certain degree of stability acquired in that training, then one should, or the teacher should teach them the instructions to how to cultivate the ultimate bodhicitta. So, for that reason, this portion is organized in this version of text of mind training, 7-point mind training, here at this point. In the other one, in the many of those earlier one, it comes in the beginning, before the instructions how to train in relative and conventional bodhicitta. And the 7-point mind training is an important text, and in fact, it's the most important mind training text, and it is used as a root text by many later commentaries and later commentators. And there are a whole lot of texts and the kind of works on mind training written by great masters of past. But the difference here is the 7-point mind training, this text comes with a kind of complete set of instructions. What should one do in the preliminaries and the actual instruction? What should one do later on? What are the those? How should one transform the bad circumstances into path? And a whole lot of those things. And it presents the mind training in a form of a complete training. And there are some other texts on mind training which just focuses on certain portion of it. Like the one that the wheel of the sharp weapon. It focuses more on this portion that drive all blames into one very strongly. And it is a very powerful text. It put forward so many type of analysis and contemplation to establish that only the self-grasping of our own self, only the self-cherishing thought of our own self is the real kind of that, culprit, is the real, convicted culprit. It's a very powerful method, but it is not a complete, it doesn't provide the complete instruction to how to train in a complete manner in a mind training instructions. So that that kind of lot of kind of texts are there on mind training, but none of them is kind of comparable to this text, the 7-point mind training, which is very outstanding and unique in making the whole and every instruction which is necessary to train the mind available in one brief text. So it is the greatness of this text that we should understand. So after that, the next line is, regard all phenomena as dreams. Now here, consider phenomena to be like a dream, and here, ponder that phenomena are like a dream. So, differences in wording. So what does it mean? All the things that we can perceive, that we can see outside there, of course, when we talk about the phenomena, it is not just limited up to what we can see outside there. There is a whole lot of the phenomena that we cannot see, but we can hear. There are other things that we cannot see, we can hear, we cannot hear and we cannot see, but we can smell. There are a whole lot of such things. But anyhow, our life is dominated by seeing things, you know. Anyhow, it is like that. And most of the time, there are many people who don't like to believe something exists which cannot be seen, you know. Anyway, all those things that exist, that can be seen, it is very important to understand that all these things, these are merely an appearance. It's nothing more than an appearance. Especially, these are kind of absence. These are absent of those true nature. There is nothing even of the size of a tiniest particle of atom or neutrons or something like that that may exist in true nature or by inherent nature, by an independent nature. So need to understand the things in that way. So what does it mean to regard all phenomena as dreams? Means things just appear to us, but it doesn't exist in the way how it appears to us. The we do how to say we do cling on the kind of inherent existence of the phenomena. Why we do that? Because when the things appear to us, it appears through some kind of in a certain degree of with a certain degree of illusion, and as it appears to us, we just accept that it exists in the way that it appears to us, but in reality it doesn't exist in the way it appears to us. The kind of good example always is the kid, you know, that I take. The kid and its toy. To the kid, it appears like this is the most valuable thing in the world. His or her own toy. This is the most valuable thing in the world. This is the most precious thing in the world. And driven by that, the kid accepts it like that and thinks that this is the most valuable thing and cherishes it from the depth of his heart. But this is the most valuable thing. That is how it appears to the kid. And it is all because of kids being innocent. Kids being not knowing the true nature and the real nature of the toy. So for that reason, when that small toy, which could be around few dollars, kind of in terms of its price, if it is lost, the kid may be completely, extremely upset. If it is broken, the kid may be extremely upset. It's so precious to him. It's so precious to her. In the same way, to us, as long as we are living under the influence of, control of ignorance, a sense of innocence-ness, with kind of not knowing the real truth, not knowing the ultimate truth of the phenomena. The phenomena also appears to us in a kind of, in a form of true nature, and we accept it. It exists like that, and driven by that, we do hold a whole lot of those things. Like, same example comes back when we go to the market, supermarket. We get that desirous attachment coming out. It is deeply rooted into that ignorance, sense of innocence, not knowing that real truth, not comprehending that real truth. As long as we remain that, the possibility to produce these things, these delusions, always remains there. So for that reason, it is very important to understand the phenomena that is surrounding us, whatever we can see, whatever we can feel, whatever we can hear, whatever we can smell, is like a magic. When you go to see a magic show, if the magician shows a dao coming from his hat, do you believe that a dove will come out of his hat? Of course you don't believe that. But you can see that a dove is coming out of his hat. And if the magician shows out some kind of flower coming out of his hanky, do you believe that a hanky can produce a flower? Of course not. But you can see that. So we need to have same approach towards the phenomena surrounding us. Though it appears like it's existing from an inherent nature, but it doesn't exist in that way. How it appears to me. So this is important to understand in that way, unless it could be always confusing. Then the next word is examine the nature of, so you say examine the nature of unborn awareness. Examine? Okay, examine the nature of unborn awareness. And in this one, it says that analyze the nature of ungenerated awareness. And in this one, it says that discern the basic nature of awareness that has not arising, that has no arising. So, same word, different translations, like that. Anyway, what does it mean? It is not just the phenomena that externally existing is like a magic. The way it appears to us, it doesn't really exist in that way. It is not just those phenomena out there. Even our own mind, even those things that exist within ourselves, our own consciousness, our own senses, even those too exist in that way. Those two, to us, appears like it is existing from its inherent nature. But in reality, those are absent of their own inherent nature. So they are never born into the inherent nature. They are never born in the kind of true nature. So that is the meaning of unborn awareness or unborn consciousness. We can also say consciousness. So nature of unborn consciousness is empty of inherent nature or absent from true nature. So we need to examine that, or we need to analyze that, and we need to try to comprehend that through the analysis, through the examination, or through, in the other words, through the investigation. Then the next line is self-liberate even the antidote, and which is here, even the antidote itself is naturally free. And here, the opponent itself liberates itself in its own place. So the thing here is, Now we, through these two lines, we try to establish the absence of inherent nature. Absence of inherent nature on those external phenomena, and absence of inherent nature on the inner phenomena. Now, inner and external, all these phenomena, we try to establish the absence of inherent nature on these things through this analysis, through this investigation and examination that we have gone through. Now, what about this established absence of inherent nature? What about that, which is normally named emptiness? What about that? Is that something that exists inherently? Is that something that have this kind of nature of a special capacity? How it appears, it exists in that, it's the way it appears. Is it like that? So here, he says as self-liberate even the antidote. So even that very established, well-established absence of the inherent nature itself is further absence of its own inherent nature. It even itself, it doesn't exist in the way it appears to us. So it is also, it also exists in a way like the magic. Though it appears to us, but it doesn't appear, it doesn't exist in the way that it appears. So there is no possibility at all, even tiniest particle, to be inherently existing. Inherent existence is something that we have to negate in every time, in every corner, and in every any kind of possibility. We have to just negate it. There is no place that inherent existence can exist in any form. Then the let the path rest in the nature of alaya, the essence. Focus on the nature of the basis of all, the entity of the path. And in this one, says that the essential nature of the path is to settle within a state of the all-encompassing basis. So, quite a lot of differences in translation, but anyhow, this means so, if we comprehend and if we kind of understand the emptiness, the ultimate nature of everything that exists, then that knowledge of emptiness, that wisdom of emptiness, can lead us to liberation or achievement of liberation. Now, if, on the other hand, if we don't comprehend and understand the emptiness, then there is no way that we can liberate ourselves. And if we are not liberated, then we will continuously suffer and keep roaming and wandering in the samsara. So for that reason, the emptiness itself is the base of everything, base of whole, the mundane and the transmundane existence. Worldly and kind of nirvanic existence. Upon that, from this very nature of the absence of inherent existence comes out all the phenomena. For that reason, we need to maintain the path in the kind of nature of alaya, that is a reference, that is a kind of a type of a noun used in various texts. In this sense, it is a use for the emptiness. This word can be used in various contexts, in various other, very specific texts of kind of Buddhist philosophy. But in here, the alaya reference for the emptiness. It doesn't really refer for that repository mind. That is a kind of special portion of the philosophical explanation of the Chittamatran school. So it's very important to maintain the path in kind of in the emptiness means make it understand and comprehend the emptiness. Then the next line here is, in the post-meditation, be the child of illusion. But here I think I should better change it to, in the post-meditation, be like a magician. You know? So in this translation it says that between sessions, be an illusionist. And in this translation, it says that between sessions, act like an illusory person. So all the different things. What does it mean, like, between the sessions of the meditation, or in certain cases, in terms of meditating on the kind of ultimate bodhicitta, after that, the practitioner should try to feel himself or herself like a magician. How does it do that? The like a magic and like a magician, this is two different expression here. In many occasions we use this expression, the ultimate truth is like a magic. So what does it mean? It means that things does exist but are absent of inherent nature. So it's like a magic. Things appear that, but it doesn't exist in the way that it appears. But it does exist, something there. Does exist, but not the way that, how it appears. So that is one way of the explanation of the ultimate truth is like magic. Now, in this sense, the magician is here a reference like this. Things are empty of its inherent nature, but it does appear like it is inherently existing. And it appears to everyone like that, especially to the magician. Most of the viewers, and especially if it is an innocent kid, they believe that the magician has produced a dove from the hat, and a flower from the hanky. But to the magician itself, it appears like that. But magician have 100% comprehension and knowledge that it is not, the flower is not coming out of the hanky, and dove is not coming out of the hat. Though it appears to him like that, in the similar way it appears to the public, it appears to the audience. But he has 100% conviction and knowledge that it is not like that. So, in the post-meditation, while in the meditation on the emptiness, of course, there is no appearance of the any external phenomena. So there is no appearance of the inherent existence at all. But when the meditator arises from that meditative state and starts looking around, things appear to that meditator. Things appear to that meditator, and meditator knows that though it appear like it is inherently existing, but it is 100% sure, the meditator is 100% sure that it is empty of inherent nature. That is how, like I say, in the post-meditation, be like a magician. But different translation put in a different way. Between sessions, be an illusionist. Illusionist and meditation, kind of a magician, same. So it's almost same. But here it's like it's a little bit difficult. Within the state of all, between sessions, act like an illusory person. I think illusory person is something different, you know. It could not, illusory person is not a magician, you know. It could be something different. Maybe a person produced from the illusion, something like that. Anyway, it is like that. So, okay. For today, we are going to stop here. Of course, we have one more page left over, but most of these things, we can move very fast. Because these are just counting of certain commitments and advices. So these are the most main instructions, that those are very important, that we need to explain in detail. The rest of these things are just, we need to count those pledges and those special advices related to the mind training. So it will be definitely, it will definitely move very fast. Okay, it's like that for today. So we have few minutes. If you have any question, you're most welcome. Please.
Thank you, Kim Rinpoche. I was wondering if one has a complete realization of relative bodhicitta and ultimate bodhicitta completely, what need is there to practice anything higher, like the higher tantras?
Of course, yes. It's dependent on what's your goal and what's your objective. A highly realized person in the field of the two bodhicittas, if their goal is to achieve the Buddhahood as fast and as early as possible, of course they need to go through that path, which can only be done by practicing Tantra. Okay, please. Yeah.
Rinpoche, I had a bit of a problem distinguishing when we talked about the three objects and the three poisons and three seeds of virtue, and distinguishing a neutral object and then one of the seeds of virtue, which is detachment. Seemed like I thought that was the same thing.
Okay. All these objects are the external things. Now, seeds of virtue are inside ourselves. So this is something different. Seeds of virtue, when we are talking about seeds of virtue, all those are a kind of mental functioning and mental factors, or a certain mental kind of substances. And now, the objects are normally, it's all a reference to the external things that we get into contact with from our five senses. So neutral object is something like which don't trigger the wish to have it, a sense of desire to acquire it and have it, and also it doesn't trigger a sense of willingness to distance yourself away from that. So that is a kind of a neutral object. Now, not normally, neutral object will never activate our mind to that active level. As soon as we come into contact with those things, the mind will remain kind of inactive and maintain that. In certain cases, that will maintain the dullness. So that is the neutral object. But when we talk about the roots of virtue, it is all inner consciousness, in the level of consciousness. Roots of virtue attained through absence or stoppage of the attachment. Or roots of virtue attained through stoppage and absence of hatred or anger. And roots of a virtue through the absence and stoppage of that mental dullness or mental a sense of inactiveness. So these are all the inner things. So it's a two different thing. You understand?
I think in the past I thought of it was good to have to think of things as being neutral objects, rather than bringing attachment or bringing hatred. The object was a neutral one. I thought that was a good thing, and okay. It seems like it's not a good thing.
Okay. Another thing is, how does it work to trigger those things? This is an important interesting thing. We live in a world where we cannot avoid coming into contact with the objects. Because objects are always around us. So there is no way that we can't interact with objects. Objects are always around us. But the best approach is to cultivate those roots of virtues. Like reduce the desirous attachment. So if the desirous attachment is reduced and controlled and is maintained, absence of it, Even if an attractive object coming forward to us, it doesn't matter. So control the hatred and anger, and try to reduce them. Try to reduce those up to a level that those will never arise. If someone managed to do that, then if they get into contact with those ugly and unsoothing objects, those things will never arise. So the inner control is very important. But for a beginner, it is very challenging. It is very challenging. It's a constant challenge, from the day one, that you are always bombarded by all these things in our life. So how to do that? It's always challenging. So for that reason, Buddha always taught to his disciples to seek the solitude, live in the mountain, so that you can have less contact with these things. That is very suitable for the beginners. But once someone is well trained in these trainings, once someone has attained, achieved certain degree of stability in these practices, they can keep moving out all over the world. They can go to the supermarket and those department stores, malls, and without any problem. So for the beginner, it is always good to stay away from the object, which may stimulate these disturbing things.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, we have one and one more question from Lee, and then this final, okay?
Rinpoche?
Yeah.
As you mentioned before, that this kind of training mainly should be introduced to the people who are willing to go into the bodhicitta practice. And for most of us, we are not even in the preliminary level. And when we step in here, there is a danger because we are walking in a very fine line. Pretty soon we end up assuming that we possess all the good quality, while others not. But while we are trying to practice the tonglen, giving our goodness to others and take the bad of others into us. So this is very real. So please give us some advice to avoid this kind of pitfall. Thank you.
You see, to be a suitable and quality practitioner of mind training, qualified practitioner of mind training, we need to go through all those conditions, preconditions. But at the same time, it is also an approach of previous masters that even if the students are not well trained in those things to apply in their own life at this level, at this point, but it is good for them to know these values. If they know these amazing and wonderful values, at least knowing that will help them to generate a deep sense of yearning and admiration. What wonderful values these are. How wonderful it could be to able to believe those values, though we are not capable to do that at present. So if that kind of admiration and yearning is cultivated, then that will definitely help a lot in the long run. Of course, we are meant to suffer until we get liberated. So in the long run, having that kind of admiration cultivated will be a great help so that we can come back in contact with these messages in the future lifetimes and if we have worked enough in between, then we could be matured enough and ripened enough, suitable enough to carry those instructions in those lifetimes and then apply in our life and then kind of evolve in the path. But for the beginners, it is always advisable to say that if you are not capable, try to have a deep sense of admiration, driven by some kind of understanding, some kind of devotion, some kind of yearning, seeing a great value of these things, seeing the pricelessness, kind of preciousness of these values and instructions. That is something that I can say. Please.
Thank you, Ken Rinpoche, for your previous teaching. You just remind us about the recall of the teaching. And I just recall my teacher always teach us and always remind us, doesn't matter what you practice every day, you have to do two things, accumulation and purification, your negativity. And he said, doesn't matter, your practice is long or short, profound or simple, you have to do two things. Everyday life is accumulation, accumulate merit and purify negativity. And my teacher said, and if you want to be a Mahayanist, you have to practice six perfection. And if you want to practice Tantra, you have to practice three principles of the path. And he said, if you want to fly to the enlightenment, you have to have two wings, the wing of bodhicitta, and one wing is wisdom of emptiness. And if I would like to practice Tantra, would you please, Ken Rinpoche, with your great wisdom and compassion, do you teach us how to practice three principles of the path?
I think three principles of the path is a very, very kind of extensive topic. Unless we do a special course on that, it cannot be done in this short time, in a brief manner. Generally, you know the three principal aspects of the path. There is a text, and it counts the renunciation, bodhicitta, and the wisdom of the emptiness. Those are the three principal aspects of the path. Without having these basic foundations, even if someone tried to do the practice of Tantra, their practice of Tantra may never get them to any kind of higher result. More than accumulating some merit and kind of certain degree of purification of certain negativities and something like that. That will be definitely achieved, even not having the real kind of three principal aspect of the path kind of cultivated. So it's like that. But it is really kind of important to have trained in three principal aspects of the path. Now, how we relate the training into the three principal aspects of the path to this mind training, if we want to kind of address this, I can say that the instructions which relate to the training into the relative and conventional bodhicitta is a method to get out of the three principal aspect of the path, the bodhicitta itself. And those instructions just which I just explained, the instructions on how to cultivate the ultimate bodhicitta are the instructions, those relate to how to cultivate the wisdom of the emptiness and wisdom, kind of wise comprehension of the emptiness. So within these teachings, we are dealing with these two aspects of the three principal, out of the three principal aspects of the path, the bodhicitta and the wisdom of the emptiness. But indirectly here in this text, we are not dealing with the renunciation part, but it is included in that train well in the preliminaries. It is included in that, as I explained earlier. So, like three principal aspects of the path, it comes in one another whole text written by great master Tsongkhapa, but it is also included in this. The message, the kind of essential points are included also here, so we can understand it in that way. Okay, that's it for today. Thank you very much, and we should do the prayer dedications. And first is the quick return prayer. Okay, you are ready? O infinite Buddha and Bodhisattvas, your embodiment of uncontaminated, immutable great bliss, kindly pour on us now your rains of nectar from the great clouds of your pure and bright wisdom and compassion to eliminate our distress. We pray to you, an incomparable great hero, who has perfectly realized within his mind the threefold ethics hidden appears. Teachings, he who has raised a parasol of Dharma in hundreds of directions. Your body is a sun of all wonderful qualities, but all of a sudden it set into solitary peace. You have committed before infinite Buddhas to work for Dharma and sentient beings. You could not have given up your commitment. However, your presence depends on the fortunes of disciples, for the power of dependent arising is inconceivable. Please reincarnate soon as a new light of Dharma. Out of your compassion that never abandons us, please return soon as the supreme spiritual guide, a treasure house of the immense teachings of the Buddha. Avoid the eloquent insinuates of teaching that suits individuals' dispositions and capacities. Please return soon as a great king who will be known in all directions for smashing into pieces a mountain of misguided teachings and views through the power of your thunderbolt lightning of three reasons. Please return soon like your previous self, re-expert in the five major signs of bliss, whose eloquent boasts and articulation of teachings cultivate the hearts of the most close, appreciation in pure, enthusiastic minds. Please return soon as a spiritual guide, endowed with complete knowledge, kindness, and dedication in regards to the perfect view, meditation, and conduct, one who facilitates the opening of the blossoms out of that is golden teachings of Tsongkhapa, by the power of the three infallible jewels, by the power of dependent arising and engaging emptiness, by the truth of our pure thoughts and devotion. May all our aspirations be spontaneously fulfilled. Okay, the long life prayer. Okay, ready? The mere appearance of the myriad designs of your personal beauty on the surface of the mind's mirror makes one's vitality adamantine. O God of life, the true wealth, we pray to the kind eminent Guru who has abandoned all false and perfected, all realizations, who has tamed himself with the nectar of three types of morality, and who is unmet in explaining the vast scriptures. O Lord, noble protector of the whole, for the liberation of the afflicted beings of this regenerative era, sit permanently and firmly on the indestructible throne, supported by eight lions of an ocean of aeons. O moon of eloquence, the radiance of the bright light, for your excellent knowledge and virtue, serves the vast milk ocean of the doctrine of Jesus. And glittering with the splendor of jewels of liberation, do you live on. You are the unprecedented second Lord of God, arrayed with the thousand eyes that distinguish the reality of the Dharma, beautified with jeweled ornament of the love for sentient beings, possessing the hundred-pronged vajra of the smooth Adhida Dhyana. May you live long, O Supreme Guide, King of the King, endowed with the fortitude to explain hundreds of texts, with the fans and clouds that destroys the host of misleading guide, rich in the wealth of eloquent speech and position. May you live long, O Lord, with banished conceptual thought that clings to the ordinary appearance, who is mastery over the supreme revelations of the stages of time, and which whatever May you live long as Vajra holder. May the kind spiritual teachers, skilled in teaching us as key points of this path without mistake. Just as it is, may they live on. May their wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. May they be pleased to nurture us continuously throughout our lives. By the blessings of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, by the power of unerring, causal, dependent origination, by the truth of our pure aspiration, may the good results of our prayer be spontaneously fulfilled.
Give me a